Counterintuitive is centrifugal force. He initiates the spin, and the mass of his body keeps it going. This means that when you initiate an idea in your physical body, in your brain, you put it in, and you push it hard, and you repeat it until it establishes a neuronic cycle, a nerve circulation, and it keeps going. The power of that kind of thing is shown in a very simple experiment where you take a piece of jellyfish, cut a ring out of it of living jellyfish cells, and you stimulate this ring with a little electric shock, and a ripple goes round it, and when it comes back to the point of the original shock, it keeps going round. It's self-stimulating. With your initiative, you can establish inertias inside yourself of truth or falsity. Very many inertias are false, but truth can be established in the same way that falsity can be established in. So the top symbolizes self-equilibrium through continuous initiative, here and now. If you don't re-spin the top, it will fall. And that's an absolute rule. If you don't keep the initiative inside your being, in your own mind, in your own body, the inertias of the patternings of your ancestors will get you instead of you getting them. Either you keep the initiative or your ancestors have it.
Is the symbol of the top linked really to bastard? In one sense, we're all bastard, aren't we?
You're all bastard if you think that you have a terrestrial father, when your only legitimate father is God. Because, as Thomas, a poet, once said, between your love and my love, God slips the baby. No terrestrial man knows enough biochemistry to design a sperm, and therefore he is not the father. There is only one father, and that is God. And Jesus Christ is a bastard from time reckoning, because he hasn't got a terrestrial father. Neither did Gautama Buddha, neither did Zarathustra, neither did Lao Tse. In fact, all the best people are bastards, because everybody is a bastard, really. Because God is the supreme father, all derived from this concrete functional absolute. We observe that he has two sphinxes, and they are pulling his chariot. And you know the sphinx is a mysterious animal, and it symbolizes four different beings in one. They will reappear on another card later on. But they symbolize in the human head on them, humanity, in the wings that they should have, in their full form, they symbolize the intellect, the eagle's wings. The back legs are supposed to be the legs of a bull, which means your physical body, your earth nature. And the front legs are the lion. And the lion is your courage, your heart, like Richard Wan. So every human being is a physical being, that is a bull. He is a being of heart, feeling, courage, that is a lion. He is a being of intellect, the eagle, and he is a human being. He has a human face. And this human being has the peculiar job of coordinating a bull and a lion and an eagle, and persuading these in himself to drag his chariot, which is his own being. So the human being must become aware that he is an intellectual being, that he has feelings, and that he has basic urges of physicality. And with these three, intellect, feelings, and especially with courage, he can bring these into coordination and then persuade this bull's energy to follow the dictates of the eagle logic and the courage of the lion in the service of the human being. The head of the human being leads. So this boy knows something. And he keeps his moon on his left shoulder. That is, he never forgets phasicity. He never expects any being in the time process to be constant. He expects everybody to change if they exist in time. And he continuously reminds himself. The left side means intellection. So he keeps the idea. Everything is phasic. Today's promise is tomorrow's lapse. In temporal beings, that is the rule. And this he never forgets. Now this constitutes the seventh card of the tarot, and it is a proper arrangement to put them 1 to 7, and then the next 7 below them to produce various correspondences. But they are so subtle that we will not be able to deal with all the cross references tonight. So we will now recap what we've done here, and we will say we started with the absolute, which is functionally concrete, that it is holistic, seamless, that it is not made of atoms, not made of parts, and that whatever exists in the whole universe is nothing but the same concrete absolute functioning in a particular way. And that means that a human being, just an ordinary human being, a bus driver, a prime minister, whatever he may be, he is the absolute, concrete, functioning, in that way peculiar to that being that you are observing. And this means that never, at any time, or in eternity, can you as a human being be severed from this concrete, absolute whole. In that concrete, absolute whole is your only real security. And your substance is your will to substantialize yourself. You have no substance other than your own will to self-substantialization. The same power encapsulates, and this encapsulation produces our next symbol, the sphere of the high priestess. And this is cosmic. This is pure wisdom. And that means non-analyzed, total knowledge, absolutely interpenetrating itself so that all its parts are in no sense out of relation. It is permeated with significance right through itself. And at that level, it can control its own phasicity. And in that level, it has two aspects, the dark aspect, tremendous drive to fulfill its own will, and the light aspect, affirm the necessity for secrecy about the nature of purity. That is total uncommittedness. If somebody tells you you are a sinner, you can say truthfully, oh, that refers to my temporal activities up to now, but absolutely I am spotless. I didn't invent that. That happens to be a truth. St. Paul puts it in this way. He says, the devil's chief weapon is the conviction of sin. That means if you can be persuaded that you are a sinner and define the sin as a private, egotistical, negative act, and then, on the basis of this, condemn you, negate you, destroy your will, reduce you, so you spend the rest of, the rest of your life compensating for this sin. You may go to the jungles of Africa and have reverence for life to beetles in the jungle to compensate for a sin. This is the conviction of sin. But if you understand that principle, yaqeen, affirm that secret, stabilize yourself and say, I am not touched fundamentally by my behavior. I'm as pure today as I was before I fell in the tar bath. And underneath the tar, I'm still pure. And then the devil can't get you. Nobody can get you. If you know that your sins are superficial, they can only appear on your periphery as erroneous ideas. They cannot penetrate to the depth of your being, which is a spotless white light from the eternal. The Empress is the first temporal authority, the matriarch. She overplays the game And remember, empresses still overplay the game. They have favorites. Favorites of the heart, of the affections, which cause them to be irrational in their behavior. So that they create resentments. And the resentments they create feed back and eventually overthrow them. So any man and woman who feels this matriarchal tendency to dominate a situation in terms of her own willfulness, she may get away with it. Weeks, months, even years. But she cannot get away with it forever because she's breeding resentment all the time. And one day it will overthrow her. In the same way that in a man, if he allows his materialistic self-protection bias to dominate him, it will overthrow first his reason and make him make mistakes, and then the mistakes will feed back and destroy his material body. The emperor, discerning the tricks played, usurps the authority of the empress and sets himself in authority in the name of Ram, the high absolute energies. And he says, "Nevermore will I kneel before this goddess, because she has deceived me beyond all justification, because she has kept from me my own creativity." Because when women kept secret the fact which they knew that men impregnated them, they negated the creativity in the man. And if the matriarchs had had their way, society would have been an identical pattern today as it was then, because they allowed no change, because they denied the creativity of men. So that when this revolt comes, they find it extremely difficult to forgive this. Not that they were deceived, but that they were deceived about their creativity, that they were told, "You cannot create. You are merely a slave to my magic." And when a creative being is deceived and made to be non-creative, and then later discovers that he could have been creative, he gets very, very annoyed. So the emperor overthrows it. And he carries in his symbol the same that she had, but he's now elongated the male aspect and reduced the female. But he hasn't put her underneath him, he's put her on top. Because he knows that fundamentally her willfulness and his willfulness are the same. And he is going to use his willfulness instead of hers. Therefore he carries the same symbol, but he gives it a different interpretation. The high priest, a brother of the emperor, connives with him to establish a tremendously impressive, colossal series of symbols which will relatively produce minitude in the observers, so that man will realize he is as nothing compared with the great cosmos itself. And on the basis of this, he will establish a hierarchy of knee-benders. Now they have their function, because until a human being can control his own eagle, his own lion, his own bull, he deserves to have his leg pulled. And these are the chief leg pullers. They are pulling the legs of the human race for the sake of human evolution, not merely for monetary gain. That's an accident that happens to large organized religions. The accumulations of fortunes is just an accident. It is not by design and it occurs, and therefore they never feel guilty about it. It's just that small coinage wears holes in pockets and less likely to do so in brass trays. You want me to mention the cross keys? I haven't mentioned a lot of them. The cross keys, of course, are supposed to come from Peter. But careful reading of the particular passage will show that it has nothing whatever to do with Peter. It has to do with the concept of binding and loosening. I will give you the keys of binding and loosening. And what it means quite simply is this. The high priest has the right to say to you, I bind you, you are sinning, or I absolve you, you are no longer a sinner. This is the two keys. The power of the hierarchy to define whether you are still a sinner, unforgiven, or a sinner, forgiven. If you're unforgiven, you feel terrible, and often you do a bad job. But if you're forgiven, you feel quite pleased, and you do a better job. There's a certain kind of economy about the two keys that is worth meditating about. The lovers, as we said, symbolize this. Human beings must breed with human beings, and preferably the best human beings with the best human beings. And after this will come progressively a more and more evolved humanity. And the definitions of the hierarchy, working in collaboration with the emperor, shall save people who don't know how to think clearly about themselves and who factually, historically went outside the human race for their relations of a sexual order, that they shall confine themselves to humanity and the best to the best. And out of this they will build up from the earth a mountain of attainment by selective, intelligent breeding. Now, there's a lot of people in the world who are profoundly disturbed by anybody who talks about selective, intelligent breeding, because a lot of people in the world think that they are not intelligent. And they think that they're not going to be allowed to breed. Now, if there is a mistake at all on the part of the men who were talking about selective breeding, it was to mention it. Because obviously they shouldn't have mentioned it. They should have simply got on with it without rousing the opposition. But some of them had a sense of humor and said, if we do mention it, we'll create such opposition that we'll sharpen our own wits. And because of the fact that an emperor or a hierophant has gone down, the sons of God have gone with the daughters of women, somewhere down below there are intelligent people, and they will get the message, and they will select, and the whole human race will gradually climb up until it reaches divine status. So even in exposing this relationship, in showing it in its starkness, different function for man, different function for woman, and nothing but function is the difference. They're not protoplasmically different. They're only functionally different. Physically, emotionally, mentally. In exposing this, it sharpens up the evolutionary interplay, the sparks of the two poles. And then finally here, in this chariot here, we have a son who from his father's side, either military or ecclesiastical, has derived information through heredity, and that information has enabled him to drive forth from his father's kingdom, because he doesn't think he's going to get the throne there, because there are other sons who are legitimate. So he's going to drive forth and go into another country, and there he's going to do all the things that the emperor and the Hierophant did on the society in which he was born, on another society. And by this man, this son of a militarist or of an ecclesiastic, the world is going to be civilized. So we find a peculiar relation. The army and the church, of all the great religions, they go out, they send out their bastard sons, or anybody at all who's got intelligence, which from their point of view must be a bastard son, because you can only get intelligence that way, and they send them out to farthest outposts of empire, knowing that if there are any other beings there, the hereditament of the father will be imposed on these beings and will create a new society of a similar pattern and intention to the old one. And then they will be able to trade, and gradually they will build up world dominion. And the whole earth will then be changed. There'll be a new heaven, that means a new concept of power, and a new earth. That means a new application. All depends on the inevitable development, the absolute self-encapsulation, the high priestess, precipitation of that woman into time, the empress, her mishandling of the situation by emotional favoritism, creating the resentment, the frustration that forces the male into more clear intellection, so that man's intellect is actually a product of the irrationality of the female. And then the intellect of man revolting and establishing a counter-hierarchy to the female's malearchy. Then the designing of evolutionary rules for the human race by the hierarchy, the rules of the sacredness of sex and marriage, and then the production of the bastard son who goes out in space to make another world, another society, and ever climbing to a higher and higher level of self-conscious will, until that particular top spinning there is the key to the development of every human individual. Remember the top. The peg through it means the letter I, initiative, masculinity, intellection. And the disc through which it goes symbolizes inertia, repetition, the feminine, the material. And you have both aspects, and you can only keep your balance by continuous use of your initiative. If your initiative fails, your top wobbles and falls. So that, in a simple symbol, is the meaning of the whole sequence of cards. The absolute has precipitated, and always in the bastard son, always in the Christ figure, the Buddhic figure, the Zarathustrian figure, the one with no father on earth, he is the recipient of the absolute will to deny terrestrial paternity, and thereby to become an individual in his own right, self-determined, self-reflexive, self-volitional, self-evaluating, and able to create a new world as from himself. Now, I think although we've only done 7 cards, I think we've done enough of time being. Three quarters of an hour is left. The richness of the symbolism of each card makes it practically impossible to deal with anyone adequately under 2,160 years. So you'll have to forgive the compression that we will undergo. And Deb has made an important point about the bastard son symbol being the top spinning. And Golda has pointed out the top spinning is drawn as a cross. That's a non-perspective diagram. That's your disc edge on the horizontal, and the vertical is the pin through it. And the reason it belongs specifically to the bastard son is because he is the one who has no official support. So if he's going to get on a throne anywhere, it will have to be by initiative. He can't rely on the mechanics and inertias of hereditary forces and social inertias coming down to impose on him a crown that he may not, in fact, have the initiative to keep. The real king has initiative. And that means the symbol of the top is applicable to the man of initiative. And the bastard is the only one who is really under the threat of not arriving on the throne unless he uses his initiative. Anybody else could have the blessing of the father or the mother or the archbishop, but the bastard must fight his own way there.
Why the addition?
Yes. The candle burning at both ends does not refer merely, but it does refer to it in the same sense. Burning the candle at both ends means that when you're burning it at the low end, phallically, you must burn it also at the top end, intellectually, which means to say that you must be a light at both ends. Because if you are not a light at the top end, you are not comprehending the full significance of the relation into which you are entering. So the magician holds this to say, as above, so below. You must think of the candle below as a reflection of the one above. You know the word phallus means shining, bright, like pharos, a lighthouse. And usually in psychological symbology, it is demoted. The one that points down is called penile force because it leads to penalties. You know the word penalty has the same etymology as penile. And punire, to punish, means to negate power. Now your power in the infinite cannot be negated, so you don't have a word that signifies potential negation. You have the word phallus, which means supreme, bright, industrious, flaming, self-illuminating being. Whereas the penile force carries you down into the realm of time and matter and exposes you to reprisals in the time process. So you must always remember, in every situation into which you enter, you must keep the light of your consciousness fully alert on what you are doing. Because if you are not knowing what you are doing in the minutest detail, what you are doing is valueless to you. Only that which you assimilate consciously in act is valuable to you. And if that were not so, then millions of people who have had polarized relations would be illuminated. But they are not, because they are not conscious of what they are doing or why they are doing it in the minutest detail. So burn your candle at both ends. And as the bottom end tends to burn easily, concentrate on the top end and make quite sure that your consciousness is very clear when you are doing anything whatever in the time process.
You were talking in the comments about the high priestess about emotive charges produced in chemistry which conditions the individual and then passed on to the children.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone's being interpenetrated by everybody else's behaviour anyway, aren't they? The biofield left on the yard.
Yes. And that is a generalized influence as opposed to a specific influence. You might put it in this way. If we got a bowl of water and we got a lot of little fountain pen fillers, old style, little tubes of glass with rubber thingy-bobbies on top, bulb, and we got a lot of friends to sit round the bowl and then to drop colored inks, different colors, out of their droppers into the water, then those adjacent would colour each other more than those that were widely separated, although the whole water would be coloured ultimately by all of them, yet the most immediate influence is of adjacents on each other. And therefore the influence of fathers on sons, mothers on daughters, is far more immediate and observable from parent to child than it is from parent to another parent at the antipodes.
You're talking in a serial sense now, aren't you? And yet you also talk about simultaneity.
Well, they both occur. Seriality is simply selecting from simultaneity by finiting your sense organ.
Yes, but you're using a demonstration in words of these inks colouring one another merely because of adjacency, and you're allowing a time factor in relation to this. You also say things happen simultaneously. There is no time. So
the time is a serialization of the eternal. But the time is a valid process within the eternal. It is based on rotation. And the rotation means encapsulation. And the encapsulation means a relative functional isolation. So there is a time process. And there is serial contagion from one being to another, as well as simultaneous infection. But the serial one manifests in the time process more obviously than the eternal one. Otherwise, people would not doubt the existence of the absolute. The absolute is so subtle that if you focus on the time, space, matter aspect serially, you think that the absolute is an abstraction. It's viewpoint. You hold your hand up and you see five digits sticking out. You bring your eye close and then you have to look at one of them and you serialize because you are too close. It is when you focus closely that serialization begins. To focus on the object is to generate seriality.
I'm not concerned with what the individual sees merely because they're temporary identified. It's just facts of interpenetration simultaneously. And it has as much value, it seems, as far as the individual development is concerned, than a serial process.
Yes, but you are concerned.
You don't know whether one or the other is operative.
No, but you are actually concerned with the serialization of time because you are concerned.
Yes, but the eternal presents itself in time.
Yes. And you are concerned.
Simultaneity.
Yes.
If you like,
but
that interpenetration also presents itself in time.
Well, of course, it does not for any being whose organs of perception are finite. It is serialized by the organ of perception. And your temporal concern for your individual welfare and development, this concern is a product of serialization. If you had the simultaneity of the eternal, you would not be concerned in this temporal sense.
But we are the microcosm, and all things are contained in our being, here and now.
Yes.
We're
Yes, but your finite organs of perception and your finite memory structures continuously serialize it.
Yes.
So that if you don't actually still the mind serializing, you do not regain your simultaneity.
But it's there.
Oh, it's there, yes, but it's non-effective. If you find a schizophrenic or a person with some kind of mania, they're made profoundly ill by it in time, and they're hospitalized in time, and they're treated in time. It's very easy to say, but actually they're simultaneously all right. But they don't feel all right to themselves in their state of identification.
This is what you would say when you mean, isn't it, when you say that you are in spotted?
Yes.
When you are pure.
If you shift the accent out of the serial into the simultaneous, mm-hmm. out of the temporal into the eternal, mm-hmm. you've done that trick, let go, let go. And if you can do that, then your problem vanishes. But the amount of energy involved by your ancestors in serial processes has conditioned your protoplasm, so that it's quite difficult to do that without a lot of hard training.
Yes. Does that mean then that
this copy gets in from the absolute? Yes. Mm. What mystics call noughting is to cross out every percept as it occurs. Actually, yes. Do that in the mind. Supposing I'm talking to you and I said a word, I look back at it and say the word I said was word. Between these two words, there is nothing whatever happening inside me. I'm not thinking, I'm not remembering. The records are there. If the consciousness focuses backwards, it recaptures a sentence. If it focuses forwards, it projects a sentence from the past over the present. But if it looks in the present, it sees nothing. Because there is nothing. If I am to recognize you, I must know you again. But this is an act of memory. It's retrospective. I look at that configuration, and then I dig in my mind and look for a configuration like it, and I say, oh, that's Jesse's image. But that's memory. If I am to note you properly, I must not know what you are immediately. And then whatever you do, I am not surprised by it. I can only be surprised if you do something out of phase with my memory image of you. Can't I? So if I deal with you in the immediate here and now, you can't surprise me. But because I don't know you. You can say anything, do anything.
But in that day, you absolutely know her as well.
I mean, you don't know each other because you might have an image, and I could change that image before I met you. So it would be wrong if you went to the past image, but I wouldn't be that person.
You'd be right if you thought your past image was a past image, but you wouldn't be right if you thought it was a present image. In yoga, you have three times, past, present, and future, and you must separate them. When you look in your mind, you must know that what you're looking at is memory, such percentage, present, this configuration of no significance, future, such percentage, projection from the past over the present, because you have no future other than a plan of your past projected over the present. The present is nothing. Because when you look at it backwards, you think to yourself, certain elements in it you don't want to repeat. So you'd rather not have your future projected out of your past. But if you have a future, it is nothing but projection from the past. If you want to be really creative, you don't want a future or a past. You want a here now, immediate, total involvement. I don't distinguish between you and me, here now, because that's a configuration. Like my hand is another configuration. And there's Michael there, and David there, and another David there, and Arthur there, and my hand there, like that. If I arrange them in a certain way, I can get a frame for one face, frame for another, frame another, frame another. Now, if I frame them like this, I'm getting a color patch on my retina. And if I don't refer to my memory, I don't know what it is. But if you don't know that I don't know what it is probable that you will do something from your memory. And then you've typed yourself. Not from my memory. Because I don't know you. But I'll deal with you as you are in the here now, immediately. So I can't really be surprised if suddenly you look like an angel and then the next second like a tiger, because I didn't know who you were anyway. And I don't want to know, because if I do, I'm being dictated to by my memory of you. And that I don't want, because you finish with it.
And yet you have to deal with people as you are.
That's easy, because they keep remembering.
They're already patterned in a certain sort of way, so you can't do that dismissal.
No, because if they show me the same pattern today that they showed me yesterday, I don't need to remember what it was yesterday, do I? Because they're doing it again today. I just deal with it as it is now. If they show it to me a million years, I won't even get any quicker at it with the rehearsal. Because I don't remember they've done it before. They do. And very often they'll say so. They might even apologize for having done it before. Then I take the apology as a unique verbalization of something that they obviously know what they're talking about, and therefore I don't need to, do I? Because they are actually controlling our relationship with their attitude.
But what is your state of recall? Once you have a state
of recall? Recall? From where?
Not to recall until they gyrate enough to remind you of what you would otherwise see in them. So they do a double memory, don't want you.
Well put.
But then you now remember them for their sake, respecting their presence. So do you now re-remember them, or do you keep forgetting?
Yes. Very well put, that David.
It's a real question, and I've had
to
recently.
Correct, yes. There are two kinds of recall. One is recall of past temporal experience, and the other is recall, or let's call it invocation, of eternity into time. Now, in eternity, you are everything that you could possibly be in time, but simultaneously. So if I recall your eternality, I'm recalling a very rich thing with an infinity of possible behavior patterns in it. At once, I see a certain form here, signifying thought, another one signifying a certain kind of curiosity, another one signifying a certain kind of determination, certain kind of appetite, and so on, means a simultaneous, it's a gestalt, a total configuration, simultaneously presented. Now, in the past, in my relation with you, you have shown only a very minute quantity of those possibilities of action for you. So I might recall your past behavior as a past temporal event. And if I did that, I'd be silly. Because if I did that, I'd be impoverishing my appreciation of you. But if I recall your eternity into the temporal, that's the instant, where the eternal instands into the here-now moment, then I'm calling in a very rich being. In that case, you might be being terribly serious about a past temporal event, and I might see that you're kidding. Not only you, but me, if I accept it. And I can see that you're doing it deliberately from your eternality. And therefore, I too will get the same feeling you've got. And then the message will go, and you will say, well, I will change the form of it. Because you have an infinity of response abilities from eternity. And you have only a finite number of response abilities in time.
So the anxiety would have been before it was pronounced in fact. It will now improve by that very relationship. And therefore, it doesn't arise.
It would be seen as a logical possibility, but no more.
So I'm very happy with the conclusion. That I was rather ashamed of, embarrassed by not knowing the country.
When in the Bhagavad Gita it says worship is continual remembrance, it does not mean remembrance of past temporal events. That's ridiculous, isn't it? Because you've done so many rubbishy, nonsensical, unworthy activities in time, and if you bothered to remember those, one has. That one. Chief functioner. He has done them, and we are mere modalities of the absolute will. If we waste our time in those temporal errors, we're being silly to ourselves. But if we worship by our continuous remembrance of the equation Atman equals Brahman. Brahman means the infinite extended evaluator. Atman means the same evaluator at any intersection point. Atman, the individuated self. Brahman, the extended self. There is no Atman or individuated self other than the extended self intersecting itself. So at the point of your individuated self-awareness, you are Brahman, self-cognizant of your affinity. So you're two at once. You're a circle with a dot in it, and you can rub the circle out and become para-Brahman, beyond this dualism. Because it just as in the ocean, you have many waves traveling about, and you have intersections, and if you're on a high rock overlooking the sea, you can see one ocean and many ripples crossing and many shadows on the sand from these ripples, and they look like individuals, and the little vortices look like individuals, but there's only one ocean. And you can say, this vortex is this ocean. Quite legitimately. Remove the ocean, the vortex vanishes. And if you tried to find, cut this vortex out and lift it out of the ocean, it vanishes. So really, it is the ocean that is making that little vortex. It is this infinite Brahman, this extended absolute, that is the individual human psyche. The human self is this infinite extended omniscient being. But if it identifies with its finity, it self-imposes finite content to consciousness. No good blaming the absolute. It is the absolute blaming itself.
Any part
of that is represented at all. Yes. That is the theory of the continuum, of course. any part of the continuum is all the continuum, because part means function and nothing else. Be that. Highly improbable. Have a good try, Anne. Yeah. I hope so. Quite. I'll give you one significance of it then, and that is that human peoples have developed north of the equator. So if you go and look at the globe spinning in space and look at it from the North Pole and the South Pole, you will find it looks as if it's rotating in opposite directions. And it is the people north of the equator who have made all the terminology. So they must think that because the sun, the northern hemisphere people, moves from east to south to west, so that when you face south, which you do if you're a sun worshipper, the east is on your left and the west is on your right, they call this the right way of doing it. If they had evolved below the equator, they would not have said that. But you see that a bit late, aren't they? Because they're all colonials. They did start in the north and move south. And that was not an accident, because the land mass on the earth moved up towards the north as part of the evolutionary necessity. The earth could not have developed, and the humanity could not have developed, if all the land mass of the earth had been spread like a band around the equator, and you'd had two oceans of the same size, north and south, then evolution would have been totally different. It's this drift of the landmass to the north that determined the growth of cultures on Earth and made them northern hemisphere cultures. So that to be Australian is to be Australia outside the law. To be in the Antipodes was to be outside the stream of northern cultures. It's really tremendously important to know that. That the landmass moving north conditioned the whole evolution of the human race. The whole distribution of those forces. And the Mediterranean, locked as it is. And the cultures around the Mediterranean. All these determine the history of the human race in a very logical manner. Well, it's a point of view that is valid because it's based on geodetics. It's based on the earth itself, on measurements on the earth, on geological facts. Your spinal column viewed from above is twisted. You have a different distribution of nerves on the right and left, and nervous impulses. So there's a large percentage of people that tend to be right-handed compared with left-handed people. And the right-hand side of the body is more linked with the volitional and the conational, and the left side with the cognitive and the intellective. So it is not a true symmetry in the body. And this asymmetry that exists is a reflex of the asymmetry of the distribution of land masses on the earth. And the earth is what it is because it's in the solar system at a certain orbital distance from the sun, and the solar system is at a certain distance from a star group far out. But all these factors connive to make human beings human, to make them a mediating being, with a body of earth packed with gross impulses and an intellect that belongs in the stars and a will that belongs in the sun. These are not accidents. They are cosmic involutional facts. There are no abstractions in the sense that materialists tend to think about ideas. Ideas are real and concrete, and they are forces. And these forces interplay with geological forces. You know perfectly well that the way the earth shrank conditioned the way it folded. The way it folded made mountain ranges. The way the mountain ranges were determined the flow of rivers. The way the rivers went out to their seas and made deltas determined the cultures of the human race. So from primary masses of incandescent gas shrinking and becoming solar system, planetary system, earth, shrink, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, mountains, rains, rivers, cultures. And this is not abstract, it is concrete. There aren't any abstracts. Everything is concrete in itself. The subtlest idea is a concrete energy. Emotion is concrete. Emotion self-precipitated is chemistry. Chemistry is predisposition, it is fate. It's very simple. If you don't let go of the continuum, it becomes complex, which simply means with folds, if you forget the continuum.
May I ask a question? On the emotional level, why is it so easy for an individual to remember than to forget? And on the intellectual level, it's easier for them to forget than remember. Is this something to
do? You mean statistically, yeah, don't you?
Yes, well, I mean, people on the emotional level, as far as pleasure and pain, remember everything from the emotional point of view and don't forget.
Yes, well, the cause of that is excessive energy input. You are a mass of protoplasm. When energy comes from outside that you call a stimulus, that energy entering into you either comes slowly enough or in a form simple enough for you to assimilate it to your existing internal pattern. Now, if you can assimilate it like that, you are intellectual about it. But if it comes at you too strong, it bypasses your formal assimilating device, your cortex, and it goes underneath that. And there, you are perpetually on guard about it, simply because you have not intellectually assimilated it. Therefore, your emotive memory is very good. In fact, I was just talking to Roy about it earlier, at the door, about the elementary fact, which at first, we didn't see an example until I said, he's a musician. And I said, don't you associate particular works of music with particular girls? And his eyes immediately lit up. Oh, yes. He knew to whom and when and where he first played the Firebird. Why? Mm-hmm. It remembers because there was too much energy in it for the cortex to assimilate. If you can assimilate it in the cortex formally, the fact that it is formally assimilated means it goes into equilibrium. But that's dead. You see, that's dead. The function of the intellect is to kill things. That's the important thing. And the object of Jnana Yoga, that is intellectual yoga, is to kill everything. Mm-hmm. And when you've killed everything, you are back in the absolute.
Because you're forgetting everything
that happens. Yes.
But the function of the idea, as you said at the beginning, for this talk, it's the form thing. Hmm?
Yes, idea is form.
And therefore, an idea, there must be a crystallization or a condensation
of mm-hmm. Yes. And the reason you are to do this is because someone has already done it. Beings have formulated, they have handbooks of trickery. And it was all right once upon a time before creation. But when creation started, certain beings, through frustration, acquired formal knowledge, which was trickery. They could then impose on those people who had not yet acquired it. Because of the great law, every spirit seeks a body. If you get an electromagnetic field and put a piece of iron in the field, this field will orientate towards this piece of iron. If you get an emotional field and put an idea in it, it will orientate to the idea. So a very smart trickster can insert an idea in your emotional field. And if you don't know the rules, you will orientate to that idea. either to embrace it as valuable or to try to push it away. That's a negative orientation. And it's possible to put a fence around something and say, mad dog, keep out. And people keep out. The mad dog you were referring to was the fellow who kept out. But he doesn't know that. It's always an interpretation.
If you say the intellect kills it, are you saying that if you wish to use your intellect to remember what Gerald was saying about memory and the intellect, then that you require a considerable amount of energy in order to remember?
Yes.
What about using emotion as a technique in remembering?
The emotion is energy.
If you want to remember things intellectually, are you saying it's a good technique to use your emotion in order to...
Yes. Well, another word for emotion is interest. Actually, you have a perfect memory where you're interested.
Yes,
the first time I find a man who's in love with a girl who doesn't know where she lives, then I will abandon that proposition. They can remember the most fantastic things if they're interested. It arises through the accumulation of frustration. Imagine in the universe to begin with, when it first appears, the fact of rotation of forces. If you look at the spiral nebulae, you will see great masses of incandescent gas spinning. And they're spinning into centers. Look in another part of the sky, you'll see one a little more advanced. And there it's got a sun, or perhaps several, and smaller ones. And it will cool progressively. And the smaller ones will cool first, and they will become planets, and they will carry on circulating in the solid state as they were doing in the gaseous state. And wherever you are coming to be in the universe, the amount of energy available for you is peculiar to your place of coming to be. So if you come to be on the North Pole and on the equator and on the South Pole, you have necessarily a different energy distribution. And we call this the law of the inequality of finites, which says no two finite beings can be the same in all respects, physically, life force-wise, desire pattern-wise, rationally, volitionally. They cannot be the same in any of these levels. And therefore, some beings are more willful than others, and stronger. And those ones, historically, have pushed around the weaker ones. They have got hold of them, factually, put chains around their necks and marched them away from their own village and beaten them and said, you will now draw water for us, and you will now dig the ground, and you will now go over there and work in a mine, because we like gold necklace. One of our members of the royal family has a toothbrush, studded in diamonds. I don't know whether she throws it away when the bristles have worn out, or whether she has it re-bristled. And this is actually what happened historically, that the strong impose on the weak. So who got smart? The strong or the weak? The weak. This is what Nietzsche complains about the men of the Golden Age. They were so busy being willful, if a skull got in their way, they just knocked it out of the way. Sometimes they didn't kill it outright, they just cracked it a bit, and it went away and healed with an engram of the crack and a picture of the man who made it. Because protoplasm is the perfect recording instrument. And so out of an accumulation of cracked skulls through generations arose a brilliant discovery, thought. Because golden-haired men of the old days didn't think. They just immediately responded. You got a beautiful little silver filly there, I'll have that. And the silver owner had said, filly, it's thrown to the ground, foot put in his mouth. Do you want more? No, thank you. Right, take it away. But these fellows who were trodden upon, rotten little fellows, as the supermen say, they brood, you know. They are resentful swine. It's a mark of inferiority, this. Resentment in the presence of greatness. Dislike for a heel pressed in the small of the back. Rotten tights. They brood, they think. They do worse, they become rational. They plot, and they get smart. You know what we have to do with them? Make them our managers. Because they've got smart. And what do? We go away crusading. And we need them in charge. Some of us get killed, who cares? The world is eternal. Some of us don't get killed, and we come back, and what do we find? The manager in charge. And he's so well in with the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, they prefer him to me. This is history. So some men are left-handed. Did you get the first bit, Herbert?
No. Oh, I did.
You didn't? Small girl like you, a disgrace to Sagittarianism. All it meant to say was that the frustration was pushed into one side of the brain. Your brain is not dead symmetrical in its function. And all your resentments and frustrations are recorded in certain centers. And then, as a result of accumulations of these, when your nervous impulses pass from the brain into action, they cannot go out into the right hand, which is used for punching, they go into the left hand, which means you're a twister. So that all keggy-handed fellows are frowned upon in wildest Yorkshire as not trustworthy. And it's only left-handers. If I happen to be looking at one now, I should keep my eye on him as much as I do on a right-hander. For exactly opposite reasons. Is that clearer?
Yes,
thank you.
He should do nothing, because we don't like shoulds, musts, and oughts. But a left-hander, natural, say like my friend David, has become ambidextrous, not through being flogged by a wicked father, but through seeing the virtue of the arbitrariness of the will and the usefulness of the left-handed cunning. You know, David needs watching doubly, because now he's ambidextrous. Now, I'm a simple case. I can't use my left hand at all. The only need to watch is my right. Now, never compel yourself to do anything whatever contrary to your insight. If you have an insight, you acquire a talent spontaneously and easily. If you don't have that insight, and you try to acquire a talent, or have one imposed on you by parents or educators, you are damaging your physical structure and your psychic structure. Acquire nothing except where your intelligence tells you it is beneficial to acquire it.